Okay, then before you ask questions, there's three or four things I like to say about the meeting so that you can feel comfortable. Number one, I always like to tell people in a weekday why I'm not in Washington, because most Monday through Fridays, you know, we're in Washington. But in this particular case, we have Easter break, and it's usually something we have every year, so we can count on it. So this gives me an opportunity to travel the counties and do what I do with my Q&A with my constituents. Secondly, I like to have meetings like this because it gives you a chance to look at me and me look at you. But also, if this is the only way we communicated, I wouldn't get very much opinion. So I hope when you can't be with me here, you would email me or postal mail me, or sometimes people call in their positions or whatever they want to say. And if you leave your name and address, we answer on paper back to you. So I like to tell you about the two-way communication, because if you're going to have representative government, you got to know what's on your constituents' minds. So if you email me and don't get an answer, write me a nasty letter and ask me why I didn't answer your letter. The other thing is, I like my one-way communication to you, not that any of you got time to get in the weeds on all the stuff that I have out there, but just in case, I have all my speeches and press releases on grassley.senate.gov. My staff does Facebook, but a lot of people communicate with us that way. I do Twitter at Chuck Grassley, and I do Instagram at Senator Chuck Grassley. So that's the ways you can communicate. Now, since there's a long ways from here back there, and somebody in the back of the room asked me a question, I may walk back there. But if I've got my back turned to you, yell at me if you got your hand up, and I'm not looking at you, see. So I think those are all the things I say to open a meeting. Well, maybe I better say this. I'll get you first. As long as you had your hand up, I won't forget you. You're right here. Anyway, sometimes you might ask two questions, and I answer one, and you think I'm afraid to answer the second one. I probably forgot it. So tell me again, I didn't answer. Or some, like one case, a constituent started asking me about, I thought, Medicaid, and so I gave a long answer in Medicaid, and she says, no, I mean Medicare. Well, don't wait till I get 5-minute answer before you cut me off. See, you're first.
Thank you, Senator. Now, try to speak to the back a little bit so they can hear me.
Yes, do that.
I usually don't have any trouble with people hearing me, okay. Senator. I'm John Worden, the county attorney. Okay. I want to thank you for your leadership on the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Protection Act. And I came in a couple times and talked to you about that. Don't really want to talk about that as much as, could you comment for the folks about my perception of there being actually a great amount of bipartisanship in Washington, and JJDPA is a prime example.
Yeah, okay. I'll give just a short explanation before I answer your question. Criminal justice reform, called the First Step Act, because it isn't meant to be the last step on criminal justice reform. It was very bipartisan. Senator Durbin, the Democrat whip, and I led the effort over a period of 3 years to get it passed. And who would have ever thought that President Trump, that's so strong on law enforcement, would ever sign a bill or be supportive of a bill like that? And he was very supportive of it. And we got it through, and it's the first really change in criminal justice law for a long time, and it's for about a generation. So it takes some of the unfairness out of the system, I guess is the word I should use. out of the system of putting people in prison. Now to answer his question, I'm going to use this as an explanation or as an example of answering your question. If it's not adequate, tell me and I'll try another way. Okay, you probably know that when judges are up, that's very controversial. It seems like Republicans are for the judges, the Democrats are against the judges. That's out of my committee that I chaired for 4 years. So you would think, well, Republicans and Democrats never talk to each other. But as an example of just exactly the opposite, and so this is my answer to your question, there's a great deal of partisanship, as emphasized by 61 bills coming out of my committee. Every one of those bills were bipartisan bills, and 45 of those bills passed the United States Senate, and 34 of them got to a president, either Republican or Democrat, to sign. So everything is not partisan. There's a great deal of partisanship. Another way to answer his question, and I didn't mean to give three or four answers to your question, but another way to answer it is, ask my friend the newspaper person, he's right over there, ask him if you don't think what I'm telling you, and if he disagrees with me, he can speak up right now. But controversy makes news in Washington, D.C. So when we're arguing about something, and that doesn't mean we aren't friends, but we're arguing about something, and all that disagreement shows up in the newspaper, the television, or the radio, and you've got Fox News and you at one end, and you've got MSNBC at the other end, and it's all controversy, controversy, controversy. So you get a distorted view of partisanship in Washington, D.C. So like this gentleman said, your county attorney said, we work on a bill that is the most changing of the system in a generation. It doesn't even get much attention, as revolutionary as that is. So you see, you get a kind of distorted position. Is there too much partisanship in Washington? Yes, but not as much as you might think. Okay, next question. Yes.
My name is Don Leerholt, and as you being in Iowa, you know that if you want to know something, you go to the horse's mouth. But if you go to the other end of the horse, it might be tainted. So the thing I'm getting at here is the Mueller report is redacted and it's coming out. My question is to you. You represent all of us, right? Whether we're Republicans or Democrats.
Yes.
You represent them.
I sure hope so.
Okay, my question to you, are you going to be able to read the unredacted Mueller report? And if you see something, you will let us know.
Yes and no. The yes is that I'm going to read everything you can read and the redacted. Now, if I want to know what's in the redacted portion, particularly if it deals with national security, and I don't want to say anything right now beyond national security, I can be briefed on that in what we call a secure room where I can get the information. And for national security reasons, you don't tell your enemies what you're going to do, or you don't tell your enemies where you're going to get your information. So you try to protect that. But I get briefings like that quite regularly, and I can be briefed on the same thing that's in the Mueller report. Then there's another redaction that I hope you would agree would be legitimate. So there's three reasons for redaction. The second one then would be, let's say you, sir, your name's in there, but you haven't done anything wrong, you haven't been charged, but they have to question you. Okay, should your reputation be ruined when you didn't have anything to do with it, but you got caught up in the web? So those names will be redacted. And then the other one would be, the other one is by law, grand jury testimony. Grand juries are always secret, so you get as much truth as you can. If nothing's going to get out, anybody that's got testimony to give that might say somebody should be prosecuted or not prosecuted. So only those three things.
Well, I might expand on that a little bit. The fact is, if we have a Playboy magazine, and we're going to go ahead and get it so it's readable by a teenager, probably every page in the magazine would be redacted, right? So I'm really depending on you to let me know if there's something that, as a country, you know, this Russian deal and all that, if there's in something that really is a problem, that they're messing up our democracy, that's me. I want you to let me know that isn't happening.
See, I don't know the way Mueller did his job and the way that you heard Republicans, probably more Republicans than Democrats, bring up this point, that the people he hired, a lot of the lawyers he hired, and I don't know whether it's most of them or just a few of them or what, but a lot of his top lawyers were people that are known to have contributed to Hillary Clinton's campaign. Now, the only reason I bring that up is because if Mueller, who already has a good reputation, and if there's people that presumably would have never wanted Trump to be president, were working on the investigation, and they all came up with the fact that there wasn't any collusion, that doesn't make it 100% absolute, but it sure ought to give a great deal of credibility to what Mueller concluded. Okay, next question. Go ahead.
Okay, so about 3 or 4 weeks prior, there's an MSNBC report about Homeland Security, DHS, as it gets through distribution channels throughout the state as far as child care and allocation as far as homes. There was a report as far as them following young adolescent women's menstrual cycles. I know there's been convoluted reports as far as Egyptian carving and manipulation as far as mind control to try to dictate these girls' features. I talked to the Secretary of State and I got no correspondence, and I was wondering if you guys have any transparency, because when the percentages, you know, people judge. People lie, men and women lie, numbers don't lie, and what I'm seeing across the board, like, if we want to really get down to brass and tacks, wholeheartedly, and I'm not going to apologize for this, there's more child trafficking going across the borders than there is across this southern tier. And that's what concerns me, because we're getting a very convoluted message. And I think from the Latino community, you're getting work ethic, transparency. And I'm not negating MS-13, gang affiliation, all that, but I've also seen, let me be devil's advocate, I've also seen the most loyal police officers for Tulsa Police Department see a former MS-13 gang member as somebody like that who exists, give him an opportunity. And so I'm just asking to shed light on very thick money and convoluted that you're well aware of. And it's time to shed light on it, because we're looking out for our kiddos. He owes me us, you know.
The only thing I can promise you is, the only thing I can promise you is that because everything you bring up that you wanted to be transparent, I would not know about, because it would be part of a police or law enforcement investigation. And while those things are going on, the police aren't going to talk about it, because the more you talk about it, the more somebody's going to know something. So the only thing I can promise you is that once the investigation's done and the charges are filed, that there's going to be full transparency at that point. But prior to that, you don't want any member of Congress screwing around with a police investigation or a law enforcement thing that's going on, unless you have reason to believe they aren't doing their job. Then you have a responsibility to step in. Like right now, I'm investigating a killing by Interior Park Police of somebody on George Washington Parkway in Northern Virginia, and the FBI has put hours and hours into it, and I'm trying to find out who killed who or the facts of it, and I get stalled, and this is over a year now, I get stalled because the investigation is ongoing. If it's a legitimate ongoing investigation, then I'm willing to wait. But the fact is that I didn't even get acknowledgement for a long time that there was even an investigation going on. So I still pursue it. Okay, next question. Stand up, please.
Yes, there's been a lot of questions for the last 6 weeks, you know, something in the...
Can I ask you to start over, please?
Okay. My question is, it's been something that is big for the last 6 to 8 months now, and for the security, is the president and everybody else for North Korea, are they going to actually stop that nuclear missile sites, or what are they going to do for that part? Because I know this is such a big thing going on for them.
The only certainty, there is no answer to your question that I can give you now, only to say this, that there's several mistakes that three presidents before this president has made with North Korea, that if this president keeps his word, that there might be a chance of it. The last three presidents, and the only one I'm going to talk about is George W. Bush, because it's the only one that I studied real closely, but the same principle. You think you can sit down and negotiate, and they're going to do something. And the reason they sit, North Korea sits down with us and negotiates, is because we got tariffs on, not tariffs, sanctions on that are hurting them. And so these sanctions is what brings them to the table. Then, like George W. Bush, but you could, two other presidents did practically the same thing. You get to a point where the Secretary of State for George W. Bush says, well, I think I got them negotiating. And they'll go further if you take the sanctions off. So then we take the sanctions off and nothing happened. That's happened three times. So this is what the president said when he walked away from, he didn't walk away from the first one. The first one was done. They didn't really sign much of an agreement, just that they were agreeing to continue to negotiate and thought there was good chance of progress. The president was asked at the news conference, do you think that you really accomplished something? Or maybe he was asked, well, what do you think about Kim Jong-un? And in either case, he said that I think things are going along all right. I could be making a mistake, but if I'm making a mistake, the sanctions are staying on. So if he keeps the sanctions on, then I think that something's going to happen, or then the sanctions will stay on if nothing happens. See?
I have a couple of questions.
Yes.
I'm Jeff Abbott. And,
my name is Jeff
Abbott. I was wondering if all the government had a paid holiday, like for example, 2 years, no increase, how much would you save in order to bring down the deficit for the country?
Well, I can't give you an exact figure, but if you, your question is if you limited everybody to 2 weeks of vacation instead of 4 weeks.
Well, 2 years of pay limit.
Oh.
There's no increase in,
okay,
in the annual.
Yes. You just save tens of billions of dollars. I can't give you an exact figure. You'd save an awful lot of money.
But they won't do it, huh?
The only people that don't get raises since 2009 are members of Congress.
Okay.
Everybody else gets raises.
Okay.
The salary of a congressman has not increased from 2009, maybe I better say 2010, just to be safe. See?
And then another question I have is, all this time they were talking about right for the handicapped, you know, they are a kind of nation. But I was thinking, all these years they try to tell me to read people's lips and talk English that I'm hearing impaired. So why not three required basic languages, English, Spanish, and sign language for all the students, so that when they go out in the world, they can also blend in the handicap with sign language sometimes they need to use it.
Okay. So can I ask you, is this interpreting your question right?
No.
That you would like to have students be trained in three different languages?
Yes. And then they learn other languages if they want.
Okay.
But those three require education for everybody in the school system, in the whole part of the country.
Yeah. I think the chances of doing that are very slim. But we're becoming more of a multi-language country every day. But by the time people get to be the second generation, so you're really talking about a problem we have for the first generation of immigrants. By the second generation, most everybody's speaking English. And then, you know, unlike when I was growing up, French was the international language. Today, mostly English is the international language. So it is a problem, I think, for first generation, but not beyond that.
So it's hard to get the students, the young people, to learn sign language?
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood your question.
I mean, because why should I always be learned to speak when they could learn sign language? Yeah. It would be easier in the workplace and everywhere, especially in noisy environments, stuff like that.
Well, for a guy like me that's uneducated about sign language, let me tell you, it'd be practically impossible to teach that to me.
I know, God.
So I don't think that that's going to be a possible thing, that I could promise you that I could get that done. Thank you. Next one. There. You. Yeah.
I recently read in a paper that you're helping to sponsor a new anti-discrimination act for older workers. And I applaud you for doing that. I lost my good paying job about 10 years ago in the factory. I worked at closed, and I haven't been able to find a decent paying job since. And I've been hearing in many cases that a lot of younger people are being hired. In fact, I went to work in one business, and I filled in when the manager left. And I was much more experienced and much more educational background than the person they ended up hiring for a manager. Supervisors laughed at me when they laid me off. They just stood there and laughed at me as they were laying me off. Now I know why they got away with it, because they can discriminate against older workers. And I'm constantly being applying for jobs and losing out on somebody who's much younger and less experienced than me. I can't afford to stop working. I have to continue to work. And I hope that your new legislation will also prevent people from discriminating from the very beginning when they're trying to get hired. Is that a part of the new legislation?
Let me explain what the bill does. It does exactly what he said, but the background is this. We do have a law that says you can't discriminate against on age, but for, I don't know the basis of the Supreme Court decision a few years ago, but that Supreme Court decision in the case of a guy by the name of Gross from Southern Iowa was employed in Des Moines and thought for the same reason this gentleman was fired, that he was being discriminated against and he ought to be protected by this law. Now, I don't know the hair splitting that judges did, but the Supreme Court ruled that in his particular case, the age discrimination law did protect him. So I think it's ludicrous. And so this is why we've introduced this bill, to overturn the Supreme Court decision and say what we think. We who have supported the age discrimination law for decades, we're more or less telling the courts, you didn't do it right, and this is what we mean, and we were going to make it very clear to you. I think the gentleman here first, and then I'll try to get some of you. Now, those of you, you're joining, have to keep putting your hands up from time to time. Go ahead, sir.
I'm Bob Elliott. First off, I want to thank you for the job you did on the Kavanaugh hearings. I think you did an excellent job. Putting up with some of them idiots, I'm sorry. My question is what's being done about this double judicial standards? It seems like if you're a Republican, a conservative, and an ordinary person, you have to obey the laws. Yes. But if you're a Democrat, a liberal, or sometimes, and not including you, politicians, do not have to follow, or illegal immigrants do not have to follow the law. Why should the ordinary people have to be held to the higher standard than some of these Democrats and illegal immigrants?
Yeah, I think I can answer your question without referring either to Democrats or illegal immigrants. Everybody has to obey the law. And if there's any difference in fairness or unfairness, it's got to be related to what we call prosecutorial discretion. And you have to assume that that's not based upon this or that. And you're a county attorney, you can help me out with this. But there's what you call prosecutorial discretion, that there's probably some reasons to try some cases over other cases. But there should not be a discrimination within a case between somebody that is of one type or another type, or Republican or Democrat, rich or poor, illegal alien or not illegal alien. The only thing is, when you deal with illegal aliens, they broke the law to come into the country, see? And of course, that's a violation of the law and can be punished by being deported. But, we got to control the borders to get that under control. See? Okay. I'll take one over here and then I'll go back a little ways. I'll let you guys fight. Go ahead.
Let me ask you a personal question. My name's Gary Clark from Manning, Iowa. Who's your best friend in life?
Well,
this is my call. If anybody wants to know, probably not for long. Anyway, who is your best friend in life? I want to know about Grassley.
It wouldn't surprise you if I said Barbara Grassley.
Congratulations. My wife. 64 years. And yet you back a guy who's been married. How many times has Donald Trump been married? You back a guy, you rubber stamp everything he wants to do. He's got it made with you. How long have you been a senator?
Okay.
Now I want to know. I'm asking. Okay.
Well, sit down and
I want. That's a good answer, though.
You want?
Few that have ever said that. They'll say Jesus Christ or something.
38 years.
Okay.
I've been a member of the Senate.
38 years?
That's cool. I'll keep on.
Do you think that's a little long? Do you think term limits are?
No.
I used to vote for the Democrats.
No.
How about Tom Harkin?
No.
He's been there too long.
Okay.
Yeah. How long was Tom Harkin there?
Too long.
He was there too long. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Well, would it help you any if I told you in 1996, the only time the vote's been up, that I voted for term limits?
Can you turn your phone off?
He answered a good question. But why is he back somebody who's been buried so much?
What's that got to do with it?
You review people, they treat other people in life.
Okay.
Can I, before I call on anybody else?
I've been in this country for 50 years. So what?
Yeah. Could I respond? I would like to respond before you ask another question, because everybody thinks that if you're of one party and the president's of the same party, that if you aren't every day condemning that president, or if you aren't every day disagreeing with him, that somehow you support him. I'm going to give you three or four examples of where the president and I have strong differences. Tariffs as one. Separating children from their parents. Another one would be, do you realize the first communication I had with the president's counsel was, that he put out this statement January, almost immediately when he's sworn in, that he wasn't going to answer oversight letters from any members of Congress except chairman of committees. Well, out of 535 people, that means that about 480 people aren't going to be able to do any congressional oversight, and it's a constitutional responsibility that you learn in checks and balances of government that if you pass a law, you don't stop with passing a law. You make sure that you're a check on the executive branch and that you're going to make sure that that law is carried out the way Congress intended. So I raised Cain with him. I said, we got court decisions saying anybody can do oversight, not just the chairman of a committee. Well, we got those people up there, and they listened to us, and within a month, they had withdrawn that letter. Just as three examples. So don't be saying that I agree with the president all the time. Go ahead, sir.
Senator O'Brien, Wilson, president of Western Iowa Energy, and a lot of, we're made up of about 700 farmers business owners that invested in the Western Iowa Energy biodiesel plant. And just first off, I want to say thank you for all the work you've done in renewable fuels. Right now, though, we really need the blender's tax credit to come back, because what we're doing is we're losing money making biodiesel to keep up with the RFS in hopes of that coming back so we can be made whole so we can distribute back out to our investors. So I just wonder, is there anything that you can do with that needing to come from the House?
If the bill comes from the House, it won't have any trouble passing the United States Senate. We have a bill that is a bipartisan, as you all studied in government. All tax bills have to start in the House. So we can't do anything until the House sends us over a tax bill that we can deal with. So that's where we are. We're waiting for the House to act. You want to be next?
Yeah, this could be a two-part question, depending on how the first part goes. What are your thoughts on weather modification, and how does it affect the farming industry in Iowa and the Midwest, and the health of...
What do you mean by modification?
Weather modification.
Oh, weather modification.
Yeah. Geoengineering, climate control. They are currently...
You mean global warming?
No, well, they say that they're doing it for global warming, but it's been going on for quite a few years.
Okay, you mean GMOs?
No.
What do you mean?
Weather modification. You don't know it.
You're talking about seeding.
Cloud seeding, weather modification.
Yeah. Okay, I know what you're talking about now.
So, what is your stance on that, and how does it affect our farming and agriculture and our health?
I don't have enough information to answer your question, but since it isn't talked about in Washington at all in the Congress, then I have to conclude that it's not of the top priority in Congress to deal with. Now, is it your feeling Congress needs to deal with it?
Well, you did in 1978.
What did I say in 1978?
Well, the United States Senate, there was a 95th Congress second session that put together a weather modification program, problems, policy, and potential.
Yeah, probably a study. And
yes.
I don't know what the study showed.
So
I wasn't a member of the Senate that year.
When they're flying over Carroll, Iowa, like they have the last 2 days, and they're filling our skies with pollution, what does that do to us?
You're talking about commercial aircraft doing that?
No, I'm not talking about
You're talking aircraft. About special planes doing that? I don't know anything about the special planes. If you want to educate me on it, I'd be glad to have you.
I've got lots of material.
I'd like to
send it to you.
I'd like to have you do that.
I have tried to, and you haven't responded.
Listen, you just got done hearing me say something. If you don't get an answer to your letter, write me a nasty letter and ask me why I didn't answer your letter.
I have three times. I've done phone calls. I've done emails. I can look it up.
Well,
I just want to know what your stance is, but if you don't know anything about it, that concerns me even more.
Well, you can be concerned more, but if you expect every human being in the United States Senate and Congress to know everything on every issue...
I don't expect that, but what's going on in our environment is scary.
Yeah. Jan, will you get her name and find out why we haven't responded to her? By the way, do you send just to my email, or do you take the form that we have on my website? It's better.
The website.
It's better if you use the form off the website.
I did that, and then I've also made phone calls to your offices.
Okay. Do you call Washington?
Whatever number I got off the
202-224-3744.
And your local offices.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Go ahead, sir.
Old Doc Annenberg, Carolina.
I know.
I got a flashback when that lady mentioned 1978. I was your original county chairman in that primary, three-man primary.
And you haven't changed any since then.
But I remember, I don't know if you or not, but you haven't changed. You're one of us. My wife remembers you stayed at our house in the basement. You didn't have enough money to. You remember that?
Well, not, if you invite me back to your basement, I'll stay there again.
I'll volunteer right here now, if I'm alive, to be your co-chairman again in 1942. Now, just a minute now. My wife, to her dying day, she says, he's one of us. He came up to breakfast from the basement bedroom barefoot. You remember that? Anyway, I want you to visit about how we're going to keep medicine private and not government, socialized medicine, Medicare for everybody.
Okay.
I got a little help here from conservative doctors that might help you, but I know you know more than I do, and God bless you. And by the way, you've always been served us, made us proud in Iowa.
Okay. Here, here.
Thank you. The question is about Medicare for all. I figure that Medicare is a contract between senior citizens and society, and that contract needs to be kept not only for today, but for our children and grandchildren. And if you had Medicare for all, you would be very unfair to older people who have paid into it their entire life, bringing people on board right now to take advantage of it without having an investment in it. And pretty soon you might end up for Medicare for none. You're next, sir.
I'm Sal Bryant from Andrew Health Care Center. I think some of my colleagues are talking about Washington. What are we going to do, or what have we thought on rural health care, which is under siege right now? We've lost about 102 rural hospitals in the last 8 years. And there's 17 in Iowa that are at risk of closing. And I've talked to you before. I know you're supportive of this. But can you kind of give us an idea of where you think we're going next?
Yeah. What I'm going to say, probably Carroll Hospital may never take advantage of. But there's several hospitals in Iowa, but more probably in other rural states, more so than even in Iowa, that where the occupancy rate for the beds in the hospital averages about 4% for a critical access hospital. So on a voluntary basis, if a hospital wanted to give up those beds and maintain everything else that a hospital did, we would reimburse them at a higher rate than to maintain those services in rural areas, so that you'd be able to maintain almost every service that a hospital has, except if you've got to be overnight in a hospital, you'd have to be in a hospital, I think under our bill, within 30 miles. Or that 30 miles at least is important that you have a contract relationship with somebody for trauma cases where they can be taken care of very quickly because the first few hours are so important. There's two hands I see here. Either the gentleman standing up, and then if the lady will raise her hand again, either one of you.
So we're standing here in New Hope Village, which provides services for people with disabilities. Okay, the funding for cases like this is constantly being cut. Disabled people are losing their benefits. Under the current administration, he plans to cut the benefits to the disabled to the amount of $48 billion. Now, people like perceived disability tend to get under $1,000 a month, so that's a long math. So, how do we fix that? Are we going to turn back the clock as he wants to do? The current administration send all these people back to the institutions where they will receive no care and only be warehoused for long periods of time. How do we fix it?
Well, first of all, let me ask. I may, and anybody that works for this New Hope that wants to set me straight on something, feel free to do it, and I will only be embarrassed. I won't be mad. Am I not right that most of the people here are here under Medicaid?
Correct.
Right? Okay. Oh, the other one would be what?
Medicare.
Okay. Then let's start with most of them being on Medicaid. The federal government is not going to change Medicaid, so wherever you get the $48 billion figure, it can't apply to Medicaid, because what states do in 50 different ways, the federal government kind of has an open checking account. And in Iowa, the state puts up 43 cents, we put up 57 cents. So if there's going to be any, if you want an increase in Medicaid, get the states to spend more on Medicaid, and we just automatically put in that 57 cents. Now on Medicare, I don't see Medicare making any changes, so you'd have to tell me where those changes are coming and where you came up with a $48 billion figure.
The $48 billion was in several articles written various news cycles. That was the number the current administration was trying to reach by taking people off of disability and taking away their benefits. Now, SSDI, the primary care is medical.
You can't.
Whereas SSI, Medicaid,
no. Well, you can't.
If you take away the SSDI, most of the time you take away Medicare. So that means they're left with the health care out all.
The only way that you can get people off of disability, Social Security disability, is if their health conditions have changed and they can work. Because the people that are on Social Security disability, the only reason they can be on there is if they can't do anything else to make a living. See?
And then what kind of job do you think they're going to get that they will be able to support themselves without some sort of supplement?
See,
you can't live on $6 an hour.
Your question implies that my answer said that we were going to make a political decision to take people off of disability. You didn't listen. I said the only way people can be taken off of disability if there's a medical determination that they can't work.
But that's not what Social Security is doing. They're taking into consideration even the type of part-time work.
No.
If someone works part-time in a place doesn't pay a living wage,
they are making
determinations on taking the benefits away without any medical background.
I don't think any member of Congress is qualified to make a medical decision. Well, we got a few doctors in Congress, but very many members of Congress are qualified to make a decision of whether or not somebody's disabled or not. We pass the laws for the determination of how it is, and in this particular case, it's that you can't do anything. Then you're entitled to disability. Your next question.
Chuck?
Tom Fox has an Iowa pharmacy in Maine, and I will talk several times. He's visiting your office. In order to point out Doc Annenberg, it's a little bit more complicated with health care than just separating one together. For you, talking about your committee's going up against the drug companies as far as cost of drugs. Now, I can tell you, for us who are providers, we have found that our reimbursements have gotten lower and lower and lower over the course of the last 15 years. And the companies that have that, where those prices have come in there, are not so much from the drug companies as it is the insurance companies. In a letter that I wrote to you, I said, follow the money. And companies, I'm not talking about the Walmarts, and I'm not talking about, you know, the principals. I'm talking about Caremark, Express Scripts, the what we call pharmacy benefit managers. The pharmacy benefit managers gleaned Caremark last year and had over $10 billion in profit. And they take it from incentives that they charge to drug companies. One of the reasons why drugs have gone up, that drug companies have to pay incentives to these companies in order to get their product on the list. We'll see a drug that might cost me $525, but they have to incentivize Caremark all the way down to where the generic costs more than the brand. So these companies are playing kind of, I'm not going to say it's fraudulent, but it is so aggressive as far as what they undercharge a provider, to what they charge to a drug company, to what they charge to a patient, where they might get a drug at my place and might have a copay of $10, and somewhere else might be $5. And these companies have had such a huge financial impact on rural pharmacy healthcare that since I was the president of the Pharmacy Association in 2009, we have lost almost 120 rural Iowa pharmacies. In 2016, I was bleeding so much red ink to Caremark that I had to pay them to be a preferred pharmacy, $1,000 a week, to be a preferred pharmacy, to fill their prescriptions, to give you a $2 copay versus a $5 copay. There's no way that we would ever get that. That was Caremark. Humana charges me $5 a prescription to fill a prescription. I've got some companies that made me charge a patient $50 a prescription, tear back where my cost is only $5, and then I'm supposed to collect 50 from the patient, and then they claw back the rest of it. The real problem with drug pricing in America, yes, there is some blame for the drug companies, but we have to follow the money, Senator, and look at pharmacy benefit management companies. And like I've said to you, and we've had many conversations, rural pharmacy, rural healthcare needs to be treated like economic development. A pharmacy in Manning, Iowa, a pharmacy in Coon Rapids, Iowa, a hospital in Manning, a hospital in Carroll. If we are reimbursed properly and fairly, we'll always have healthcare services available 24 hours a day in those communities. You're from Bremer County. You told me one time in the story, I think you said there's only one county, your county, that has a pharmacy. I think it's your cap, right? And so, while you're investigating these, we need to take a look at pharmacy benefit management companies. And I am volunteering my services to you and anybody else to come in and have a group of providers start taking a look at rules that come from CMS. They come in and they will audit us. They can go back as far as 10 years on a pharmacy claim, audit us on that. And Caremark bought Aetna. They took like a 3 year from the Aetna contract with us. They went over 1,500 patients. They were held $40,000 of reimbursement from me that they were getting paid for, that I needed to give them currently for claims that they were auditing for 3 years previous. And it took me a year to get all that from hold for something that we never did anything wrong. So we have to take a look at trying to bring the money back that these companies are keeping and not putting back into the system. And that's all I
want
to say.
Well, along the lines of what you asked me to do, take a look at the pharmacy benefit managers. We had five companies in for a hearing last week.
Yeah, did they answer a question?
They did more pointing of fingers. But also we had seven pharmaceutical pharmaceutical manufacturers in a month before that. And if I could give you a short answer, I think your description is what we're trying to write in legislation that we hope passes on the floor in June, if we can get it put together by then. The other thing is, though, for just Medicare, not anything else, the president last June gave a speech and assigned to the Secretary of HHS to do something to get drug prices down. So 2 weeks, it would be 3 weeks ago now, Secretary Azar announced that all rebates are going to go to the consumer. Well, why would that be now, Senator? From your standpoint in dealing with them, if the government's going to look at a list price, look at what the PBM has negotiated, and it's a lower price, why would you say that the rebate wouldn't go to the consumer? I need to know from your point of view.
The other day I was called by for a Medicare prescription cost me $1,100. The company said that I was approved. I charged $1,150. That's all they would let me charge, $1,100 product. They had a $50 markup on it. They said I undercharged. I could have charged $1,200 for it. Well, I said, can I find out what then was paid by the government to the PBM? The PBM got paid $1,400. My response back, when I got the response back from the PBM, they were going to pay me $279 for that prescription, and we were going to have to eat $900 on it. Now, Caremark had a response to where you guys were doing this last January. We now see them reducing our reimbursement on our costs over the line. I used to get like 5 or 6 a day. Now I'm getting as much as 50 or 60 a week, as much as $500 protection below my cost on reimbursement on Caremark claims. So I can't tell you where cost is. The cost is like trying to throw gelatin out hoping it sticks, and where the rebate comes and how it funnels back. If you want money back from it, it has to come from the PBM, because the PBM, they glean the money for the data that's collected, they glean the money for, you know, the demographic data that comes from the prescription, they get reimbursement back from that. Plus, it is very complicated.
What you just said, the money's got to come from the PBM. That's exactly what the Secretary Azar said, the consumer's going to benefit by. Now, you said you can't get information out of HHS and CMS.
I never contacted them directly. No, I'm just telling you what I deal with on daily basis.
Okay, we know, but it's not public, and it's our job to make it public, is the extent to which rebates benefit PBS.
You remember DIR, direct and indirect remuneration? You came up, not you, Congress came up with that as a way to make a PBM reimburse the patient back to help reduce the cost for their Medicare Part B plans. They made it a quality initiative to us, and that's why pharmacies like us pay $1,000 a week in the DIR.
Back in the corner, if you haven't asked a question. The gentleman that stood up was the one that he stood up before you did in the back.
Thank you, Senator. I'm Marty Helper. I've been retired in for 3 years. I have a comment, compliment, and a question. The comment, I hope you can continue on. You're just 38 years. You've got a lot of years to go. My comment, I want to congratulate your office. I see some staff oftentimes as past president of the Iowa Dental Association or anything like that. When we have a question in your office, we have always got the reply. Thank you. When I tell first name request, I
hope
you.
The lady in the front row heard that.
Hey, you've responded about other things, so you have responded to the
question. Question to you is, if Senate File 560 coming out, it's the Ensuring Lasting Smiles Act. Your cohort here in Iowa, Senator Joni Ernst, is signed on to co-sponsor. I'd like to see your support. In this day and age, we have probably 1 in 30 or 33 children born with congenital defects or something like that. We seeing so many of the insurance companies throw these claims out or treatment out because they say it's a cost. We can do so many of these things, especially in dentistry and utero, do it cheaper now, take care of them. You don't have the psychological problems and anything else later on. I would like you to look into this and consider support.
Okay.
This gentleman has a question over here.
Chuck.
I know a little bit about it, but not enough to give you an answer right now. Go ahead.
Another popular question that you have talking about is the subject of college education, talking about free education for the next generation. Or shouldn't that sound? The Democrats are talking about that. But I think within the college itself and the administration and the work and the earnings that they get, all that kind of stuff, is goes up, and then every year, new students go into college and try to get them, try to pay for their education, and it just goes up, and it seems like that something is not working because the more they pay, the longer they have to wait to pay off during their lifetime.
If I could do something, if somebody will tell me how we can do something about tuition going up 3 or 4 times the rate of inflation, I'd do it right now. But when you've got 50 different state institutions that are operating probably in 50 different ways, and then you got about 2,000 private four-year colleges, and then you got community colleges on top of it, I'm not sure that that what we do in Washington is still going to affect the smallest college in Iowa, like Iowa Wesleyan, the same you might do a wealthy college like Grinnell in the back row.
You have to get the last question.
Okay, you're going to get the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Grassley, for being here. I want to thank the director of the Hope. You are nearly entirely funded by Medicaid, and because of that, the transition to managed care has significantly impacted the members that we provide services to, as well as ourselves as a provider. I have chose from the beginning to do things a little differently than most, the vast majority of states do, and that is they brought in all Medicaid services under the managed care umbrella at once, whereas the vast majority of states incrementally bring that in. Since 2016, there has been a managed care company that has left the state in 2017. We have a third managed care starting up again July 1st, and now we've been notified that a second managed care company is leaving the state. This creates a tremendous amount of chaos for the Medicaid members that we serve. One out of every five Iowans is on Medicaid, and so it affects a great number of Iowans. It creates a great deal of stability for Medicaid providers. And as you pointed out, the federal government contributes a majority of every cent spent of a dollar on Medicaid. Because of that, what are your thoughts about the role that the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services should play with ensuring that the program that is in the state can run smoothly, there is choice, members are receiving the services that they should?
Well, I think that that from the standpoint of the federal government, except for those services that are mandated through Medicaid, and there's very few services that are mandated at the federal level, that once a waiver's given, they're going to leave it entirely up to the states to decide how to carry it out. And of course, from that standpoint, I guess there's 38 different states have privatized their Medicaid, so that 38 different ways of doing it, and I think the federal government and CMS would has to, under the law, have respect for how those states run it as long as they meet the federal guidelines. There's one thing I hope that, I don't know to what extent this would deal with people that are your clients or not, but I recently got a legislation passed that the president signed, goes by the acronym ACE, that would try to do this to not only save money on Medicaid, but it would also enhance the quality of life for people that are on Medicaid through a healthier life, because we have a small percentage, let's say 5 to 10% of the people that are on Medicaid probably use up 40 to 50% of all the costs of Medicaid. So the idea behind the ACE legislation is to put teams of people together that are delivering health care to make sure that the people that have vulnerable health problems, and I didn't explain it, but the 5 to 10% would be people that have vulnerable health problems, to see that they're treated in a teamwork way of helping people to stay, to get well and to stay well. And that's what we're trying to do to help Medicaid, to concentrate on people that maybe don't get the proper attention, and then because they don't get proper attention taking care of their health, they in turn then end up maybe in the hospital, which is probably the highest cost of highest priced medicine to deliver, and things of that nature. So I hope you can take a look at that. Whether it qualified to apply to anybody here, I don't know for sure. Thank you all very much for participating.